So I just wanted to mention something to add on to what Randy said today about Mother's Day, which I appreciated, which is, I think it's important on Mother's Day for churches to recognize the spiritual mothers and the impact that women in the church have had on other people in the church. And I am really thankful for all the different women that impacted my kids. Some of them aren't here in the room because they're still serving in various capacities around the church, but everyone who worked with my kids in the nursery, who worked with them in Sunday school, in Awana, in high school and all that, they've had an eternal impact on my family, and I'm grateful for all the spiritual mothers in our church and just wanted to pray for them and thank all the women that have served in different capacities for our church family. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you as always when we come before you and we think about your grace and your mercy to us in our church. We ask for your blessing to be upon us. We thank you for the women that you've raised up to serve this church body over the years and the ways that they have contributed and impacted other people to help them grow in the knowledge of you. We thank you for them and ask that you would bless them in their efforts. We thank you for Mary Lynn, who oversees women's ministries, and ask that you would help women's ministries to grow. We thank you, as always, for your word and ask that you would use it to encourage each of us to remain faithful to you and to grow in our own faith. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so we are working our way through the life of Jacob. And last week, we read one of the stranger episodes in Scripture, if you think about it, where as Jacob is preparing to meet Esau and he's scared to death and he prays, and then he finds himself alone the night before the meeting is supposed to take place, and he wrestles with God. God somehow manifesting himself in human form, maybe through the angel of the Lord. But I'm not aware of any other story in the Bible where the Lord allows a human to touch him and physically struggle, whether it's an angelic representation or actually somehow God manifesting himself in the flesh, other than things associated with the incarnation that are different. Usually when an angel appears, people don't even get close enough to touch it, much less wrestle with it. So it really is amazing that Jacob has this experience. And at the end of it, his hip gets dislocated, and I argued that he prevails in the encounter, ironically, by submissing. And so he limps away from this encounter, knowing that he just saw God face to face, and as he put it, his life was spared. So that is the prelude to his encounter with Esau. In a strange way, it should have been encouraging because it reminds him that the Lord is with him and the Lord wants to bless him. So he knows that going into this encounter with Esau, but it still had to be scary because remember, Esau has 400 men with him and Esau wanted to murder him the last time he saw Esau. And so he knows that the Lord is with him. He probably believes somehow he's going to survive the encounter, but he doesn't know what that's going to look like. He doesn't know whether he's going to have to fight Esau. He doesn't know whether he's going to survive, but some of his family isn't. All of that's probably still weighing on his mind as he actually walks toward Esau and his party. So that's the background to 33:1, which is where we're going to start. Jacob looked up and there was Esau coming with his 400 men. So he sees Esau in the distance, and he makes some final preparations. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants. And I think it's interesting that divided is a very literal translation. He divided his family. And I would ask you to think about that, because I think it is true in a very deep sense. I think what he does here divides his family. And I think it's not the first time he's done it. It's not the last time he's done it. And I think it comes back to bite him. So he divides his family. We've got Leah, we've got Rachel, and the two maidservants. He put the maidservants and their children in front. Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph in the rear. And I would argue that sends a very clear message about what's most precious to Jacob and who he wants furthest from danger. He himself went on ahead and bowed to the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. So he runs to the front, and he bows down 7 times, showing, I think, remorse, and I think it's a request for forgiveness, based on the fact that he remembers what he did to Esau before he had to leave for Laban's house. So he's being extremely polite, he's being extremely humble as he approaches Esau. He's also being extremely formal. So I think it showed, that part of it, I think, shows good character from Jacob. But Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. So Esau throws aside formality, runs forward, and hugs Jacob. He kissed him, and they wept. So this is one of those things where words aren't adequate because it's so short, but it's such a huge moment. Jacob thinks this encounter could go horrible. He's worried that Esau may actually murder him, and instead Esau runs up and hugs him, and it's this wonderful moment. And the thing that came to my mind was the story of the prodigal son. Remember how he comes back to his father, doesn't know how the father's going to be, and the father runs towards him. And that's supposed to be a picture of God's love for repentant sinners. And the interesting thing about that coming to my mind is that I've argued previously, we don't think Esau is a believer. And if you read Romans 9, I don't know how you can get away from the idea that Esau isn't a believer. And so to have him do something that's a picture of divine forgiveness is really interesting. But I think it's true, and I think Jacob's even going to pick up on it later in the story. So we find out that Esau has had a change of heart. I would argue that's the product of natural maturity, but also common grace. So I believe there's this thing out there called common grace, which explains why the world and humanity is not as absolutely as horrible as we could be. Doesn't mean you're saved, doesn't bring you to salvation, but I think God gives us conscious and common grace, and so sinners aren't as bad as they could be. And Esau was exposed to a lot of common grace living in Isaac's household, and I think we see he's matured, and he's been able to forgive Jacob. So Esau looked up and saw the women and children. "Who are these with you?" he asked. Jacob answered, "They are the children God has graciously given your servant." And so one of the things we're going to see Jacob doing today is growing into his role as a spokesperson for God as the heir of the covenant. And so he attributes these children as a blessing of God, which they very much are if you follow the Abrahamic covenant. Then the maidservants and their children approached and bowed down. Next, Leah and her children came and bowed down. Last of all came Joseph and Rachel, and they too bowed down. So everyone's being extremely polite. Doesn't mean they're saying that Esau is the one who actually has the covenant blessings. They're just being polite and humble. I would argue that is the way you should be, because Jesus said in his kingdom, the greatest of all needs to be the servant of all. So they're acting as servants. Then Esau asked, "What do you mean by all these droves I met?" So one aspect of covenant blessing was the children. Another aspect of covenant blessing under the Abrahamic covenant is material prosperity. So Jacob had sent these five miniature herds ahead of him, and he says, "To find favor in your eyes, my Lord." And Esau said, "I already have plenty, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself." And notice the exchange. Jacob is still being formal and polite and referring to Esau as his Lord, which he doesn't mean he's God. That's just a polite way. It's kind of our equivalent of sir. But Esau, again dispensing with formality, refers to Jacob as his brother. "No, please," said Jacob, "if I have found favor in your eyes, accept this gift from me. For to see your face is like seeing the face of God now that you have received me favorably." So they have this little conversation that kind of reminds me of two people fighting over who gets to pay the check at a meal. You've probably experienced that dance at some point in your life. Each one saying, "No, I've got enough. You keep the gift." Jacob makes the argument, "Accept this gift from me." And I think he's arguing as a token of my appreciation for your forgiveness. Okay? Part of the reason I say that is he says, "For to see your face is like seeing the face of God now that you've received me favorably." And I think he is connecting the way Esau has received him with the forgiveness he's experienced in his life from God. And in particular, if you go back to the last chapter, remember at 32:10, as Jacob is praying, he says, "I am unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness you've shown your servant." So as he prays for deliverance from Esau, he acknowledges, "I'm not really worthy of it," right? And then later on, after he wrestles with God at verse 30, he says, "It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." And so Jacob acknowledges, "I have no right to be someone who gets all these blessings from the hand of the Lord. I have no right to stand in the presence of the Lord and even wrestle with him and survive that. I am an unholy man. I am not worthy. And so I've experienced grace." And he's acknowledging that he really hurt Esau, and yet he's experienced grace from Esau. And so the forgiveness that Esau has extended to him is in a small sense an example or an analogy to the grace he's experienced from God, and he's asking Esau to accept these animals as recognition of what Esau's done for him. Then he makes other arguments too. First he says, "Please accept the present that was brought to you, for God has been gracious to me, and I have all I need." So the second argument he makes is, "I've been blessed by God. Let me share some of that blessing with you." And if you think about the Abrahamic covenant, that's a central part of that covenant, that other peoples will be blessed through you. And those who bless you, I will bless. And so Jacob is being the vessel that this divine blessing flows through. And so he's asking Esau to let Jacob share the divine blessing with him. Okay? And because Jacob insisted, Esau accepted it. And if you remember, in that culture, that actually makes Jacob the superior one, because it's the superior one that blesses the inferior one in that culture. And so, ironically, even though Jacob goes into this calling Esau my Lord, he comes out of it as the one who blesses the other. Therefore, it's appropriate to think of Jacob as the covenant patriarch, not Esau, because Jacob is the one who actually blesses Esau, not the other way around. That's my argument. Questions, comments, concerns? Okay. So, awesome. Everyone's happy with each other. Everyone loves each other. That's great. Then Esau said, "Let us be on our way. I'll accompany you." And so here we find out in Esau's mind, the purpose of those 400 men was not to threaten Jacob, but to actually be an escort and protection for Jacob. But Jacob's not interested in it. So Jacob said to him, "My Lord knows the children are tender, and I must care for the ewes and the cows that are nursing their young. If they are driven hard just one day, all the animals will die. So let my Lord go on ahead of his servant while I move along slowly at the pace of the droves before me and that of the children until I come to my Lord in Seir." So Jacob's argument is, your party can go way faster than we can. We don't want to hold you back. You guys go ahead. I'll eventually get to where you're going to settle. We'll come back to that. But Esau said, "Then let me leave some of my men with you." So, all right, you don't have to inconvenience all 400 men, but at least let me keep some of my men here to take care of you. But Jacob still resists, again being extremely polite about it. "But why do that?" Jacob asked. "Just let me find favor in the eyes of my Lord." So Jacob argues, "I'm happy that you've forgiven me. That's enough. That's all I need from you." So that day, Esau started on his way back to Seir. Jacob, however, went to Succoth, which is in the opposite direction, but near the Promised Land, where he built a place for himself and made shelters for his livestock. That is why that place is called Succoth, which means shelters. So there's a big debate among the commentators about whether Jacob is being deceptive when he says, "Until I come to my Lord at Seir." Does Jacob know he's not going there and he's, in his essence, lying to Esau or not? And the best argument that he's not would be that this is just one of those polite exchanges people have, and Esau's being polite and offering for Jacob to come to Seir, but he doesn't really want him to come there, and he fully knows that Jacob isn't actually going to follow him there, and they're just exchanging pleasantries, okay? The best argument for that would be that eventually we're going to find out that Esau and Jacob at this point are both so wealthy in terms of animals that the land can't support them when they live next to each other, okay? And so that would suggest both of them understand that they aren't really going to be able to live right next to each other. But we don't know that that's true at the point Jacob makes this statement. So not really sure that's what's going on. The best argument that he's being deceptive is it sure looks like Esau wants to help him. Why would Jacob turn down having even some of the men with him? The best explanation is that Jacob knows those guys are going to want to go to Seir, and he's not going to want to go to Seir, and that's going to be awkward, and so that's why he doesn't want anybody to escort him, because he's not actually going to Seir. And so there's a lot of commentators, including Calvin, that say this is Jacob falling back into his old pattern of avoiding an awkward situation and trying to take control by using deception again. I tend to think the guys that are on the deception side of things are probably correct. What this shows us is, you know, even as we grow, we don't reach perfection in this lifetime. And so we see Jacob doing something really positive, which is having the courage to meet Esau. We see him handle at least the first part of that encounter very well. But there are a couple things he does that probably aren't perfect, one of which is dividing his family, and then the other is not being completely honest with Esau about his intent, where he's going to live. All right, questions, comments, concerns about that? So that is a very popular theory out there, that part of the reason he doesn't want to do this is he's still not comfortable that Esau and him are going to be able to get along. And it could be that he's worried Esau holds a grudge. It could be just that he remembers how much trouble they had getting along when they were younger, and he's worried that something would happen if they try to actually live with each other that would make Esau mad, and Esau would lose his temper and bad things would happen. So it could very much be that. So that's one of the popular theories out there, is that he's nervous about trying to actually live with Esau. As things play out, there's no evidence that they have conflict with each other after this point. But that's a popular theory. Anything else? Yeah. Yep, it's absolutely the same. Same concept, that you've got so many animals. Animals require a certain amount of space to have grazing. If you put too many animals in one spot, you destroy the land and then all your animals die. So it's exactly the same principle. Yep, good point. Mm-hmm. Yep. And you know, what's ironic about that is I would argue both men have matured. And what the conflict we see in their youth is both of them trying to grab the most stuff from the family. And who's going to be the dominant one and who's going to get the most. And it's this competition. And then as they meet as old men, they recognize they each have more than enough, and they have this weird competition to see who can be the most generous. But I would argue that's a positive competition. And so I think both men really have been matured. I would argue in Esau's case, it happened by common grace. With Jacob, it happened because he had a covenant relationship with the Lord. But it is interesting to see the difference in how they interact with each other as old men. I mean, they're both probably well over 100 years at this point. Other questions, comments? Yeah.
He's over 100 years. Wouldn't his children be really like adults now?
Yes, they are. We're going to see that. Good question. So there's a little bit of an age range, but also he's probably got kids of servants. So remember, his household at this point is not just his kids. He's got men and women servants, and they've got their own families. And so this is a big operation at this point. So they're probably small kids. They're also probably animals that have small kids. So he is not just a family, but a household at this point. All right? Good questions, comments? All right. So Then we're told after Jacob came from Paddan Aram, he arrived safely at the city of Shechem in Canaan and camped within sight of the city. For 100 pieces of silver, he bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, the plot of ground where he pitched his tent. There he set up an altar and called it El Elohe Israel, which means God, the God of Israel, or mighty is the God of Israel. So it's a way of acknowledging that God has fulfilled his promise on the way to Laban, that he would keep him safe in Laban's household and bring him safely back. The 100 pieces of silver is sort of like a security deposit. Hey, I'm going to be in the area. Is that okay? And I'm going to give you this little token. So he sets up camp near Shechem. And now I'm going to do some time management, and we're going to skip over the next chapter, but I'll summarize for it. And so what happens next eventually is that the son of the ruler of Shechem sexually assaults Dinah, Jacob's daughter. Serious crime. What do we do about it? That guy really isn't under Jacob's jurisdiction. He's under the jurisdiction of the people of Shechem. So how do we solve it? He proposes to solve it by marrying Dinah, and even proposes that, well, hey, you could stay in this area. We could start intermarrying with each other. Jacob, two of his sons, who are full sisters of Dinah, seem to take the lead in the negotiations. They are Simeon and Levi, and they deceptively agree to that plan and say, but there's one thing you guys got to do, which is to get circumcised. And so all the men of the town agree to be circumcised. And I imagine that wasn't pleasant with ancient tools. And while they, shortly after that, they, and it's probably not just them, but they probably bring male servants with them from the household, slaughter every single one of them. They loot the bodies. They take all the women and children of the town captive. So, absolute miscarriage of justice. It's one of those situations where you can start out being the victim and end up being the bad guy by murdering people that had nothing to do with the crime, and then, to make matters worse, taking advantage of women and children who really have nothing to do with the crime. And so that creates two threats for the household of Jacob. One external, which is Jacob's now worried that everyone in the region is going to hear about this and gang up and destroy his household. So there's an external threat created by this. There's also an internal threat. So one of the threats is to Jacob personally. I mean, this is essentially a miniature coup. Jacob should have been the one, as the patriarch, that handled this situation. Simeon and Levi basically say, we don't like the way you're handling it, so we're taking over. So this goes back to the comment about his children being grown. They're at the point where some of them, at least, are itching to be in charge, and this becomes a problem for Jacob. But the other threat that this created is one that ironically was identified by Simeon and Levi when they were talking to them. They said, when they were talking about the deal, we'll give you our daughters and take your daughters for ourselves, we'll settle among you and become one people with you. And if you remember, this is the big threat that Moses' audience faced when they were going into the promised land, is would you end up just becoming Canaanites? Would you go into that land, and instead of influencing them to worship the Lord, would you become influenced to worship the Canaanite way, and in essence become this weird blend of Israel and Canaan that's more Canaanite than Israel? Well, what Levi and Simeon have done has put Jacob's household in exactly that position. They now have a bunch of women and children that are Canaanites, know nothing about the Lord, and Jacob's now responsible for taking care of them. So he can't just send them off in the ancient world and say, fend for yourself. That would be a second horrible crime on top of the first one. So how is he going to handle that? Okay. So God said to Jacob, go up to Bethel and settle there and build an altar there to God who appeared to you when you were fleeing from your brother Esau. So he gets some direction from the Lord. Somehow the Lord communicates to him, leave this area, go to Bethel, set up an altar there. And then we see a moment of great spiritual leadership from Jacob. So Jacob said to his household and to all who are with him, which is going to include these people from Shechem that know nothing about the Lord, get rid of the foreign gods you have with you and purify yourselves and change your clothes. Then come, let us go up to Bethel, where I will build an altar to God who answered me in the day of my distress and who has been with me wherever I have gone. So he basically calls his household to follow him as he follows the Lord in going to Bethel and worshiping the Lord. And he explains to them exactly who the Lord is and what the Lord has done for him. So same way we witness for Christ now. This is what Jesus did for me. I think he could do it for you. I sure hope you'd be willing to follow Jesus. One interesting question is, has Jacob at this point figured out Rachel's one of the people that has foreign gods with her? We don't know. Moses doesn't tell us. It'd be interesting to know whether she still did and if she listened to Jacob. We don't know the answer to that. But what we're told is that there is generally a great response. So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods they had, and the rings in their ears. And I would love to tell you that's because pierced ears are ungodly and you all need to get rid of your pierced ears because I'm afraid of needles. But I cannot say that in good faith. We do not know why the earrings get involved in this, okay? And there are two different theories. One is that we've actually found idols from that time period that have earrings. So some commentators say maybe these rings are part of the idols. And there are other people that say, no. In the Old Testament, there are people wearing earrings all over the place. It's not unusual after a battle or something that people pitch earrings into this pile, and that becomes part of it. Maybe somehow the earrings are associated with pagan worship. Maybe these earrings had some sort of pagan symbol on them. So this is people actually getting rid of everything associated with their previous lifestyle. That includes getting rid of the old clothes and the old earrings, putting on the new clothes, and that's symbolic of them adopting this new faith in the Lord. And it is true, if you get to the Mosaic Code, when they talk about purifying, it's not unusual for purification to include getting rid of the old clothes. And when Paul talks about putting off the old man, putting on the new man, kind of lurking behind that is that idea of getting rid of your old clothes, wearing the new clothes that are appropriate to your new identity. So I think that's what's going on. So there's a positive response from the household. And then we're told they set out, and the terror of God fell upon the towns all around them so that no one pursued them. So they respond in faith, and God, despite this horrible crime that's been committed, is gracious to them and protects them. And this is one of those weird grammar things where we don't know exactly how this worked. So one way you could interpret this is God makes all the people around them afraid of God. And that's the terror of God. Alternatively, it could be God makes all the people afraid of Jacob and his family. Either way, the point is, even though these people have more earthly power than Jacob, and if they all ganged up on Jacob's household, they could destroy it, the Lord divinely causes them to be in a state of fear so that they don't do it. And it's very similar to things we see in Moses' time. And so, for example, Deuteronomy 2 talks about how, as the Israelites are wandering around, God caused the people to in the land to be terrified of them and leave them alone. Okay? Questions, comments, concerns about that? Okay, so God graciously gets them to Bethel. We're told in verse 6, Jacob and all the people with him came to Luz. That is Bethel, because Jacob is the one who renames it Bethel, in the land of Canaan. There he built an altar, and he called the place El Bethel, which is kind of redundant. Bethel means house of God. El Bethel means basically God's house of God. Not sure what's going on with that. Because it was there that God revealed himself to him when he was fleeing from his brother. And then we get this weird interjection about Deborah. Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died and was buried under the oak below Bethel. So it was named Allon Bacuth, which means oak of weeping. And so commentators estimate that this Deborah would have been 170 to 180 years old when she dies. And she's introduced to us way back when Rebekah leaves Paddan Aram to marry Isaac. And she accompanies Rebekah and becomes part of Isaac and Rebekah's household. We don't know how she ends up being part of Jacob's household at this point. One possibility is she died and they brought her body to be buried there. But we don't have any reason to think they would do that. So another possibility is that she was instrumental in raising Jacob and had a close relationship with him. And so once she knew that Jacob was back in the promised land, she came back and joined his household. But that raises all sorts of other problems. Well, if she did that, why didn't Isaac? Well, keep in mind, Isaac is also almost 180 years old and he's blind. So maybe Isaac set the point where he's alive, but he wasn't able to make that journey. We don't know. All we know is that somehow Deborah dies, and it's an important moment in Jacob's life that he recognizes by honoring her. And what it tells us is that servants, even though they're lower on the social status rung, were very important and valued members of their households. Okay. Questions, comments, concerns about Deborah? Yeah, it's a good question. The honest answer is I don't know. I think it's certainly possible. It's kind of like if something bad happens to you when you were in a bad area of town, you know, did it happen because you should have known not to go there or not? Sometimes there's no way to know. God's in control. He allowed it to happen. Could Jacob have avoided it by going straight to Bethel? Maybe, but there's nothing in the text that tells us that. So it's possible. Jacob probably wondered if there were things he could have done to prevent it from happening, but we aren't told it, so we don't know. But it is certainly possible. Anything else? I think... What we can say is they might have avoided the horrible crime at Shechem, but at some point there would have been problems with Simeon and Levi. So it might not have been that, but they seem like they were bad dudes. So I think there would have been something with them, but not necessarily that, because if what set them off was what happened to Dinah. All right, so they make it back to Bethel, and then we get this reaffirmation. So after Jacob returned from Paddan Aram, God appeared to him again and blessed him. So this is going to sound a lot like his first blessing at Bethel on the way out of the Promised Land, but I think it is a distinct and different appearance and encounter with the Lord. Because of the, it says, appeared to him again. God said to him, your name is Jacob, but you will no longer be called Jacob. Your name will be Israel. So something he said to him during the wrestling encounter gets affirmed. So he named him Israel. And God said to him, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and increase in number. A nation and a community of nations will come from your body. The land I gave to Abram and Isaac, I also give to you, and I will give this land to your descendants after you. Then God went up from him at the place where he had talked with him. Jacob set up a stone pillar at the place where God had talked with him, and he poured out a drink offering on it. He also poured oil on it. Jacob called the place where God had talked with him Bethel. So this one of the questions we have is, well, why is there this second divine encounter? I think one reason is, if you recall, the first encounter, Jacob's by himself. So this encounter happens with his household around him. And so none of his children, they've probably heard Jacob say, hey, I've had experiences with the Lord where he's made these promises to me. Sure, Dad, you know. To have this happen while his whole household is there is probably very helpful in making that real to his children and household. So I think that's one thing. We're going to see, with just a couple of exceptions, going forward from this point, Moses is going to start calling Jacob Israel. So I think the other thing that's going on here in this chapter is we're transitioning from one phase of Jacob's life that's now been successfully concluded, where he's been a flawed young man who goes off to Laban, becomes spiritually mature, and experiences the blessing of God, and sort of achieves that big milestone where he has 12 kids and he's the patriarch. And this kind of marks that milestone. And the challenges in his life are going to shift, and we've already sort of gotten a foretaste of that with Simeon and Levi, to how do we pass this on to the next generation? And who's going to emerge from these 12 sons to be a spiritual leader? And his challenges going forward are going to relate more to his kids as he enters the next phase of life. And as New Testament Christians looking back, the way that the promise is expressed this time, it's really easy to see the messianic seed lurking in this promise. For example, the idea that a nation and a community of nations will come from you has been a core part of the Abrahamic covenant from its first expression. But as Christians, we can see how that happens through Jesus as people who aren't ethnically Jewish get added to the people of God. So we're the community of nations. We're part of that. I mean, we can see that in this text really easily. We also see the promise that kings will come from your body. That eventually gets fulfilled by David, but even more importantly, by Jesus. And so we can also see the new covenant lurking in the Abrahamic covenant there. And then we get the promise of land, which runs throughout the Abrahamic covenant promises. All right, questions, comments, concerns about the Abrahamic covenant as expressed to Jacob one more time. Ooh, it might be the first time, it might not. I'm not sure, to be honest, because it gets expressed so many different ways, like, or so many different times, and the wording is not exactly the same. So I don't know. Well, no. So if you go to 17:6, there Abraham was told, I will make you very fruitful, I will make nations of you, and kings will come from you. So not the first time, but the word, it's certainly not mentioned every time the covenant is talked about. Any other? Yeah. Okay, great question. So let's actually jump forward. So we'll come back to Rachel and Benjamin, but look at verse 23. So the next thing that's going to happen is Rachel's going to die giving birth to Benjamin. And then we get this list of Jacob's 12 sons, and they're arranged by a combination of wife and birth order. So the sons of Leah who were born first are listed first. So Reuben is the firstborn of Jacob. Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun are listed next. Then the sons of Rachel, Joseph, and Benjamin. And they're a little bit out of birth order because they were actually born after the maidservants, but the maidservants were maidservants, so their kids are lower in social status, so they get listed last. Okay, so you would expect Reuben to actually be the heir by human cultural standards. He gets disqualified after Rachel dies. We'll explain why in just a second. Then Simeon would be next. Levi would be third. I think part of chapter 34's purpose is to explain why Simeon and Levi are not worthy to inherit the covenant blessings and be spiritual leaders. And so as a consequence of this, they both lose their right to a separate tribal allotment. Okay? So to us, this list of names doesn't really matter that much. To Moses' audience, it's critical because as they're moving around, they are organized by these tribes. And these tribes almost function like the 13 colonies of the United States, sort of the original subdivision of our country. These are the original subdivisions of the nation of Israel. Simeon gets a tribal allotment, but it ends up being within the allotment of Judah. So because of his nastiness, he essentially loses the right to have separate territory, although his descendants are at least in one little clump in the nation, in the tribe of Judah. Levi loses his tribal allotment, but then during the generation of Moses, he has descendants that do a really good thing, and so there's a rebellion, and they are one of the few people that stick up for Moses and actually hold other people in Israel accountable. And so the curse gets reversed, and they get to become the priestly tribe. But they still are dispersed in the nation of Israel. So as priests, they don't get their own tribal allotment. They live all throughout the nation. But they get the high spiritual status of being the priestly tribe. So what it shows is that your ancestors can have a negative impact on you, but there's always a chance to turn that into blessing. But you still end up with 12 allotments because Simeon is allotted land within the tribe of Judah. Levi gets taken out, but Joseph is going to eventually get a double portion, which is going to go to his sons Ephraim and Manasseh. So you still end up with 12 tribal allotments. But Levi's out. Simeon's within Judah, and Joseph's sons each get treated like their equivalent of Jacob's son. Fun with Ancestry.com. Any questions, comments, concerns about that? Yeah.
All of this sort out to Jesus coming from Judah?
Yes. And so part of what's going to happen in the rest of Jacob's life is we're going to see how two sons emerge, one's going to be Joseph and one's going to be Judah, that end up being worthy. And Joseph is going to get the majority of the first son blessings, but Judah is going to earn the right to be the one that produces the leader, eventually David, eventually Jesus is going to come from Judah, and we're going to see why. And so let's find out why Reuben gets disqualified. So go back to verse 16. They moved on from Bethel. While they were still some distance from Ephrath, Rachel began to give birth and had great difficulty, unfortunately very common during that time period. As she was having great difficulty in childbirth, the midwife said to her, "Don't be afraid, for you have another son." But she died. As she breathed her last, for she was dying, she named her son Ben-Oni, which means son of my trouble. But Jacob named him Benjamin, which means son of my right hand. So gave him a more positive name. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. If you go to Bethlehem, which I've never done, supposedly there's this really old shrine in the north side of Bethlehem, right outside the north entrance. No one thinks that's where she's actually buried anymore. We think it's a little bit north of that, but that's like where the tourists go. To this day, that pillar marks Rachel's tomb. So for a long time, there was a pillar. They knew exactly where she was buried. We don't anymore. But then Israel moved on again and pitched his tent beyond Migdal Eder. While Israel was living in that region, Reuben went in and slept with his father's concubine, Bilhah. So you may remember Bilhah is Rachel's maidservant, kind of becomes a substitute wife for Rachel. So there seems to be a connection between Rachel dying and Reuben doing this. And this seems to be another attempt to usurp Jacob's place of leadership. So this is, it's wrong on multiple levels. It's probably sexual assault. It is sexual assault of someone who's essentially your aunt, although not exactly. So it's offensive multiple levels to Bilhah, to Jacob. Reuben could have been killed for it. But what he's really doing is a power grab, and there's probably two aspects to it. So one is one of the ways in pagan culture you showed that you're the boss and this dude ain't is you take their women. And so when we finally get to David, and Absalom rebels against him, that's one of the things Absalom does. Okay, not very nice. Doesn't happen anymore. But so one thing commentators think is going on is Reuben is trying to say, "I'm in charge now." The second thing he may be doing too is also trying to denigrate Rachel's side of the family, because if you remember, Reuben is part of the Leah clan. And this goes back to the problem of divisions in Jacob's household and why marrying multiple wives is not a good idea and produces all sorts of bad consequences, is Reuben may not have the same concern and may even have enmity towards Rachel's side of the family. And he's associating Bilhah with Rachel, and he doesn't want Bilhah to effectively step in to Rachel's place as the favored wife over Leah. But it's really bad, and as a result of this, Reuben, even though he's firstborn, gets cut out of all the blessings. And so that's part of why we have this story. But you can see Jacob is struggling because his sons are not necessarily listening to him, and they want to be in control, and that's going to continue through the rest of Jacob's life. All right. So there we go. That was a lot of work today, but we got through two chapters, and it sets us up well as we push forward. Thanks.